Welcome to Nocturnal Tales. Tonight, New York in the roaring 1920s glitters with neon and river light. In a blue-lit nightclub off the Hudson, a cigarette girl with a dancer's poise vanishes into the night, and Poirot must follow the trail through back doors, ferry slips, and the quiet commerce of secrets. This is Poirot and the Lady of the Hudson, written by us in homage to Agatha Christie and inspired by a real mystery, the 1841 death of Mary Rogers, the beautiful cigar girl whose fate unsettled a city and echoed through literature. Our tale reimagines that tragedy on the eve of the Jazz Age crash, asking what might have happened had Hercule Poirot walked those streets. Before we begin, tell me in the comments, what do you do, either for a living or for the sheer joy of a hobby? I make a point of spending time with each reply, and I often respond. Your voices are what make this little community feel alive. Creating these stories, writing, narration, and illustration, takes many hours, and your support keeps them possible. You can join our membership for ad-free listening and extras, or leave a small tip if you wish. But know that your listening, your comments, and your shares already mean more than enough. Now, the band tunes, the river breathes, and the night opens its door. Chapter 1. The Girl with the Silver Cigarette Case. If ever a city was determined to be modern in every syllable of its name, it is New York. We had not meant to see it at all. Our true destination lay farther south, where Poirot had been engaged to give evidence in a case of inheritance at the Belgian consulate in Mexico. But the great liners make their pauses where commerce demands, and so we had disembarked for several days in Manhattan while awaiting the next vessel of the United Fruit Line. I dare say I was the more enthusiastic of the two of us. The skyscrapers, the yellow taxis, the noise and colour, it was all wonderfully alive. Poirot, by contrast, regarded the city with the careful suspicion he usually reserved for an ill-boiled egg. "It pushes upward, Hastings," he said as we stood before the pale giant of the Flatiron Building. "Always upward, like a child on stilts. But does it stand secure, Hein? It is not beauty, it is audacity." We had scarcely settled into our hotel on Fifth Avenue when an old acquaintance of Poirot's, a Belgian banker now thriving in Wall Street circles, called to pay his respects. This led, by the usual alchemy of polite society, to our being included in a dinner given by Mrs. Cornelia Van Allen, a lady whose pearls looked as though they had been strung by the gods of finance themselves. Mrs. Van Allen was determined to show us the real New York. For her, this did not mean museums or monuments, but a nightclub known as the Silver Gull, where one of the city's most talked-about cigarette girls had once been a dancer with the Ziegfeld Follies. "You cannot say you have seen America," she declared, "until you have seen Celeste LaRue." Poirot, I think, would gladly have declined, but Mrs. Van Allen's invitations had the quality of royal commands, and so we found ourselves that very evening descending into a subterranean world of blue lights, syncopated rhythms, and cocktails of doubtful legality. The room was long and low-ceilinged, with a stage at one end and a polished floor in the center, where couples swayed to the music of a small but enthusiastic orchestra. The air smelt of tobacco perfume and that curious sweetness that betrays the presence of contraband spirits. "Observe, Hastings," said Poirot, leaning toward me. "The women are of a type precise to the millimeter. The short hair, the mouth that is a scarlet exclamation, the dress that is not quite so long as yesterday, les modernes." "They're flappers, Poirot," I told him, wishing to display a little familiarity with local usage.
"Ah, the flapping!"
"It refers to the movement?" He made a small fluttering gesture with his fingers, and then smiled. "It is pretty." The dance floor was circled by tables, each with a small shaded lamp that cast a conspiratorial glow. Cigarette girls drifted among the guests, slim, bobbed young women with trays, each tray a portable shop of temptations, cigarettes, cigars, chocolates, tiny silver lighters. They were like verses of the same poem, and men bought the refrain with tips that flashed discreetly in return.
"That," Mrs. Van Allen said with the pleasure of unveiling a treasure, "is the loveliest of them all, Celeste LaRue, a Follies girl before the scandal. Everyone knows her. Everyone adores her. No one helps her."
The girl indicated Celeste stood a little apart, the tray balanced against one hip with the ease of habit. She had the lightness of a dancer even at rest, the sort of balance one sees in a good horse, poised yet ready to move.
Her face, well, there is no use in pretending otherwise, struck one first as beautiful and only afterwards as human. The features regular as if sketched, the eyes large and a shade too expressive, like lamps a trifle turned up. Her dress was black, which made her skin appear the colour of milk in a dark glass, and on her wrist lay a narrow band of silver that caught the lamp and repeated it in tiny languages.
"Before the scandal?" I asked.
"Oh, my dear, one of those theatrical nonsense stories. A very rich and very respectable gentleman took an interest. The papers said one thing, the lawyers another, and Mr. Respectability went back to his wife and clubs. Celeste came here."
"And the name of the gentleman?" Poirot asked, with all the softness of a cat that has noticed cream.
Mrs. Van Allen tilted her head. "You must pardon me, Monsieur Poirot. In New York we are modern, yes, but we are not mad. Some names are never spoken aloud in rooms where men know how to sue."
Celeste had moved closer by now, and whether by accident or by that curious tide that carries one person to another in a crowd, she came to rest at our table. She looked down at Poirot's moustaches and smiled, a small surprise smile as though the ornaments had greeted her.
"Cigarettes, gentlemen?"
"Chocolates.
I have both vices on special tonight."
"Thank you, mademoiselle. I do not smoke," said Poirot. "But I admire the efficiency with which others do."
She laughed, quick and light. "That's the word for New York, efficiency. We package our sins in nickel and cellophane. Mrs. Van Allen introduced us. Celeste, this is the famous Belgian detective and his dear friend just down from the ship." And Celeste made a little curtsy that was half mocking and half sweet.
"Famous detectives are unlucky for girls," she said.
"We read of them after the fact."
I recall now the turn of her phrase, which struck me at the time as merely clever, and now returns like a line whistled in a dark street. But I am ahead of myself.
"Tell me," Poirot said, "you have known the stage."
"Yes," she answered simply. "I was a Shoreen, one of the chorus, at the New Amsterdam, a Ziegfeld girl for a while. I still dance when the floor is free and the boss's back is turned."
"Then dance now," Mrs. Van Allen commanded. "I shall tip the band into obedience."
Celeste glanced across the room and then, with a shrug as graceful as anything I've seen, slid her tray onto the edge of a pillar and stepped into the small void between tables.
The band, suitably bribed by our hostess, slid from a foxtrot to something more liquid. It was not quite a tango, and not quite anything I knew, but it suited her. She did not perform. She inhabited the music as a person might step into a bath at exactly the right temperature. Heads turned. Even the waiters' trays seemed to pause in midair.
"Mon Dieu," Poirot breathed, "there is the geometry of grace."
When she had finished, there was a bright, murmured applause. New York is too sophisticated to clap loudly unless someone is making money from it, and she returned for her tray with a little nod of thanks. It was then I noticed a gentleman at the far table who had watched neither the dance nor the dancer, but the room. He was florid, powerful in the jaw, and very correctly dressed in a dinner jacket that looked as if it had been grown on him rather than sewn. A man with the habits of command, finance perhaps, or politics. One of his eyes had the faint, lazy droop that comes either from amusement or from indifference. I could not say which.
"Who is that?"
I asked Mrs. Van Allen. She did not turn her head.
"He is no one at all, and that is the only safe answer."
Celeste followed the direction of my glance, and for the briefest instant her composure wavered. It was no more than the tightening of a thread in a tapestry, but Poirot saw it, as he sees everything.
"You know him?" he asked.
Her smile came back, brave as a paper fan.
"Everyone knows everyone here, monsieur. It is our little village with very tall houses."
A waiter approached Celeste then and murmured something. She nodded once, gathered her tray, and drifted toward the corridor that led to the dressing rooms at the rear. The florid gentleman stood presently, made a show of greeting an acquaintance, and also moved, casually, too casually, toward the same corridor.
"Poirot," I said under my breath.
"Yes, Hastings."
"I have eyes."
"Should we?"
"We will do nothing for the moment. One does not prevent every rendezvous simply because it may end in an argument about money.
We did not have long to maintain our inaction."
10 minutes, perhaps no more, had passed. Time enough for Mrs. Van Allen to flatter the band into a fresh effort, and for me to feel hopeful of another of those illicit highballs. When a sound came from the rear that even in a nightclub cannot be mistaken, a woman's cry, choked and abruptly cut off, followed by the skitter of something metal on tile. The room hesitated as a whole creature hesitates when stung. Poirot was already on his feet.
"Come, Hastings."
We reached the corridor, which smelt of powder and damp plaster. A narrow stair descended to a service door at the alley. A cigarette case, the same narrow silver one I had noticed on Celeste's wrist, lay on the step, its chain snapped cleanly. Farther down, the door stood open a little, breathing the night. Poirot moved with an economy that made no fuss and all haste. He touched the broken chain with a gloved finger.
"Fresh," he said.
"See, the links are still sprung." We emerged into the alley that ran behind the club toward the river. It was one of those American passages that seems to have been built for the convenience of criminals, narrow, echoing, and lined with ashcans like the drums of a savage band. The night air was colder than the room, and carried a smell not of countryside freshness, but of stone and water and industry. At the far end there was motion, a shadow that separated from the larger shadow, then vanished around the corner.
"Halt!"
cried a voice behind us. It was the bouncer, too late and too indignant. Poirot ignored him and strode forward at a pace that astonished me. We gained the corner in moments, to be met by nothing but the hollow rattle of the elevated line a street away and the oblong of the river, black as a shut-eye between its lights.
"There,"
said Poirot quietly. At first I saw nothing. Then the water acknowledged its secret, a pale shape where the dock's timbers cast a small eddy. Two men, who had come running from the direction of the street, shouted for help. Another leapt down to the lower ledge and reached with a boat hook. Between them they drew the shape inward, and the lamplight, oily and unkind, fell upon a face I had seen 20 minutes before in blue music and laughter. It was Celeste Leroux. Her hair, dark and newly bobbed, had styled itself into the wet. Her eyes were closed. The silver band that had been on her wrist was gone. Below the throat, a faint dark bruising showed, a mark not of the river but of fingers. Poirot's hand on my sleeve steadied me. His voice, when he spoke, was as flat as a clerk counting coins. "You perceive, Hastings, not the water, that is after. Before the water, something else." "Strangled," I managed.
"Possibly."
"Or nearly so, and the rest accomplished by the Hudson. We shall not yet be clever." He drew himself very straight, the small figure of him suddenly set like a nail driven true. "Go back, my friend. Speak to the manager. No one leaves. There is a telephone. Summon the police. And Hastings..."
"Yes?"
"Say only that there has been an accident. The murderer hears with excellent ears when he is frightened." I went. And as I pushed back through the corridor, past the broken chain glinting like a snapped promise, the orchestra inside, not yet informed that tragedy had slid in through the alley like a draught, struck up a new tune.
The brasses laughed. The cymbal kissed the air. And somewhere near the front, a florid gentleman in a perfect dinner jacket asked for his hat, with the air of a man who is always in a hurry and never at a loss. Chapter 2. The Alley by the Hudson. The management of the Silver Gull had an admirable instinct for self-preservation. No sooner had I blurted my errand to the maitre d' than he snapped his fingers at a waiter, sent him racing for the telephone, and ordered the door shut. Guests protested. One even threatened to call his lawyer. But the man was immovable. "Lady drowned," he told the room in a tone so flat it stifled argument. "Police'll want statements. You don't like it, take it up with them." I found Poirot at the rear, standing just inside the open service door, his small figure silhouetted against the blurred glare of the alley lamps. Two patrolmen were already present, one with a notebook, the other directing the curious back inside. A sergeant, broad in the shoulders and with a jaw that looked as if it had been hammered into shape, was questioning the bouncer. Presently there arrived the inspector himself, a big man with sandy hair, a nose that had been broken at least twice, and the expression of one who has learned to meet life with suspicion first and cordiality later. He glanced at the body, now borne up to the dock on a stretcher, and then looked at Poirot with a mixture of irritation and curiosity.
"And you are?"
Poirot bowed slightly. "Hercule Poirot, at your service." The sergeant muttered something in the inspector's ear. The man's brows shot up. "The Hercule Poirot? The Belgian detective?" Poirot inclined his head modestly. "The same. I am in New York, en passant, on my way to Mexico. And tonight, mon cher, I find myself, most unfortunately, a witness." "A witness, eh?" The inspector's tone was skeptical. "Name's O'Malley. Inspector Daniel O'Malley. NYPD homicide." He pulled a cigar from his pocket and chewed on it unlit. "You may be a big shot in Europe, mister, but here we do things the American way, just so we're clear."
"Mais naturellement," Poirot replied with infuriating calm.
Statements were taken at once. The bouncer swore no one had gone out except the girl herself, and later, "a gent in a tux, maybe 50, big fellow with a red face." That description, of course, could belong to no one but the florid man I had noticed earlier. Mrs. Van Allen confirmed he had left just before the cry was heard. "Name's Franklin D. Rourke," O'Malley said, jotting it down. "Banker. Big money. Big friends. Figures." He spat out a shred of tobacco. "Well, let's see if his friends can get him out of this one."
Poirot crouched by the silver cigarette case that still lay on the stair. He examined the snap chain, then measured the links against his thumbnail.
"It was broken in violence," he murmured. "The girl struggled."
"Sure she struggled," O'Malley said. "Rourke tries to get too close. She screams. He panics and..."
He gestured toward the river. Poirot's moustaches twitched. "Perhaps. But see, there are no scratches on the metal itself. It was pulled sharply, cleanly. And the case. Observe the monogram." I bent closer. The initials CL were delicately engraved on the lid.
"Celeste Leroux," I said. "Just so," said Poirot, "yet it is curious. Why was the chain broken here, on the stair, and the body found so far down the alley?"
"She ran," O'Malley snapped. "He caught her by the wrist, snapped the chain, then..." He mimed a throttling motion.
"Don't need a Belgian detective to figure that," Poirot smiled faintly.
"No, indeed. But sometimes it is the very simple explanation that blinds us. We were escorted back inside while the patrolman sealed off the alley. The guests, restless and indignant, were herded into groups to give their statements. Cigarette smoke mingled with anxiety. In one corner, Mrs. Van Allen dabbed at her nose with a lace handkerchief, declaring loudly that New York was no longer safe for a lady. Poirot and I were shown into a small office, where O'Malley questioned us more formally. I recounted what little we had seen: Celeste's dance, her departure with the tray, the florid man following after, and the cry. Poirot added only his observation of the broken chain and the timing of events. When the inspector had finished scribbling, he leaned back in his chair. "All right, gentlemen. You're free to go, but don't leave the city without telling me." Poirot's eyebrows rose. "I assure you I have no desire to depart before the truth is found." O'Malley gave a short laugh. "That's my job, friend. Yours is to enjoy the jazz." We returned to the hotel just before 3 o'clock, both of us silent for most of the drive. At last, when the taxi had gone and we stood in the lobby, Poirot said quietly, "There is something here, Hastings, that does not please me." "The young woman was beautiful, yes?" "Too beautiful. And such women, alas, they attract the moths as the flame."
"You mean Rourke?"
"Perhaps him, perhaps another. Tell me, mon ami, when you saw her dance, did she look at him?" I considered. "Not once. She looked at us, at the room in general, but never at him."
"Exactement," Poirot said softly. "And yet, when you remarked on his presence, she faltered."
"Why?"
"Because she knew him," I suggested.
Poirot nodded. "Yes. But did she fear him, or fear what others would know of him? That is the question." The following morning's newspapers blared the story across their front pages. "Ziegfeld girl found dead in Hudson," shouted the Herald. "Celeste Leroux, romance with financier?" asked the Daily Graphic. Every paper hinted at scandal, and every paper whispered the same name, Franklin D. Rourke. We had scarcely finished breakfast when Inspector O'Malley himself arrived at the hotel. He looked less blustering in daylight, more weary, but his tone was sharp. "Thought you might like to know, Poirot. Rourke's already got himself a lawyer. One of the best. He says he left the club early to meet a friend uptown, and the friend confirms it. Alibi solid."
"And the time?" Poirot asked.
"Little after midnight, says he never even saw the girl."
Poirot pursed his lips.
"Then if that is true, who was the shadow we saw at the alley corner?"
O'Malley's eyes narrowed.
"That's exactly what I want to know.
And since you seem so clever, maybe you'll tell me."
Poirot only smiled. "Perhaps in time. But for now, may I see the girl's effects?"
O'Malley hesitated, then shrugged. "They're at the precinct.
You can come along if you like. Just don't get in my way."
At the station we were shown a small collection, the silver case with its broken chain, a compact, a pair of dance shoes, a few letters tied with ribbon. Poirot examined each item as if it were a rare artifact.
"The shoes, see, Hastings, they are worn but well cared for. The compact cheap. The cigarette case. Ah, that is of quality, sterling silver. A gift, perhaps."
O'Malley grunted. "Or bought with the tips she got off rich men." Poirot shook his head.
"No, no.
This is too personal. It was engraved. One does not engrave a trinket for a casual girl.
Non. This speaks of attachment."
He unfolded the letters, glanced at the signatures, and looked up sharply.
"But these are curious."
"They are signed only with initials, J.H.
"Let me guess," O'Malley said grimly. "Not Rourke?"
"No. Someone else entirely." Poirot tapped the ribbon against his chin. "Someone who preferred to remain unseen."
He laid down the letters and looked at us both. His eyes had the bright, hard glint I knew too well.
"Monsieur, we are about to step into deep waters. And in New York, the waters of the Hudson conceal many secrets."
Chapter 3. The Girls' Rooms and the Gentleman's Name. Newspapers have a way of deciding matters before juries are summoned. By noon, Franklin D. Rourke's name was being shaken in headlines like a terrier shakes a rat. By 2 o'clock, his attorney had thumped the same headlines flat with a statement as polished as a club window. He had not seen Celeste that night. He had left to meet a colleague on Madison Avenue.
The colleague, a Mr. Isaacson of respectable banking address, affirmed the appointment and its hour. Thus, the papers assured us, the tragedy was a lamentable misadventure, and if they could not quite make the river itself guilty, they were content to accuse New York in general and the lax morality of nightclubs in particular. Poirot, who reads newspapers as a botanist studies weeds, folded the Herald and said only, "When truth is inconvenient, she travels under an alias." Inspector O'Malley collected us at 3:30, with the air of a man who dislikes collaborators and is determined to endure them gallantly. "You wanted to see where the girl lived," he said. "You'll keep your hands in your pockets and your opinions in your heads till I ask for them."
"My hands, yes," said Poirot pleasantly. "My opinions..."
"Alas, they have independent timetables." The building was on West 47th, a thin slice of red brick with windows like shut eyes. Inside, the hallway smelt of cabbage, dust, and the ambition of girls who keep their shoes under their beds in neat pairs. The landlady, a bony woman named Mrs. Keating, whose hair seemed to have been combed into obedience rather than styled, met us with a prim distress that had dried overnight into indignation. "A good girl," she announced, as if testifying before God. "You may write it down and quote me. Quiet, paid on time, no gentleman upstairs, never the least disturbance."
"Did she receive letters?" Poirot asked.
"Plenty." "And flowers?" "The letters went in a bureau drawer, the flowers in a milk jug." "From whom?" Mrs. Keating drew herself up. "From the postman, sir." He took them from his bag and put them through the slot. "The names of donors are not my business." We followed her to Celeste's room. It was small, orderly, and, how shall I say, alive with the ghost of its late tenant. A pair of dance shoes on the chair, their ribbons rolled like sleeping snakes. A perfume bottle on the washstand, inexpensive and plucky. A photograph on the mantel. Celeste in the second row of a chorus line, one leg out, the smile switched on like a lamp. On the dressing table lay a paste brooch that wished to be diamonds. Poirot did not rummage, he regarded. He looked at the bed as though it might confess to him. He read the dust, as others read print. "Order," he murmured, and the poor little things, each kept in its place. The heart that likes symmetry often likes also to please, to conciliate. She would smile when she wished to refuse. O'Malley opened the top drawer with a professional indifference that was nevertheless respectful. There were stockings, folded, a packet of letters tied with ribbon, and at the back, an envelope without stamp or postmark. He handed the ribboned packet to Poirot and the loose envelope to me. The letters in ribbon were those we had seen at the precinct, signed J.H. The envelope contained a single stiff card with a name engraved upon it. Franklin D. Rourke, the address that of a private banking house on Wall Street.
"Souvenir?" O'Malley grunted.
"Or calling card left in person," I suggested. "Perhaps neither," said Poirot. He had loosened the ribbon, fanned the letters, and now selected one toward the middle. "Observe the dates, Hastings." I did. They began in April and ran to early July, the script neat, masculine, self-conscious in its simplicity. There were no endearments, but the form was intimate in its restraint. Dinners accepted, drives proposed, a complaint of unpleasant notice taken by the press, and finally, in the last two letters, an insistence that for both our sakes meetings should be arranged in discreet places only.
"It smells of money," said O'Malley sourly, "and of fear."
"Fear, yes," said Poirot. "But of what?" "The scandal, that is obvious. Yet there is another scent, très léger." He looked up. "Might we speak with the girl who shared the landing?" Mrs. Keating produced a Miss Kitty Boyle, small, freckled, with a laugh that kept trying to be brave and failing by intervals. She had been on the bills at a vaudeville house, had lately taken cigarette work,
and loved Celeste with that unsentimental loyalty of working girls whose coins clink alike.
"She was good, Miss LaRue," Kitty said, fastening and unfastening her hands. "Kept herself to herself.
Didn't drink. Nothing but a highball on a Saturday. And she wasn't cheap, neither. If a big man looked at her, she looked right back till he remembered he had a wife. She had wit that way."
"Did she speak of a Mr. Rourke?" asked Poirot.
Kitty's eyes flickered toward O'Malley and back. "She spoke of a gentleman, rich, set in his ways. Never said his name. Said the papers had made mischief before, and would again if they could. But Celeste said she could take care of herself.
New York's a village, she said. They talk, and when they're tired, they talk about someone else.
And J.H.? Poirot held up the ribboned letters. Kitty colored.
That was Mr. Harrow.
Harrow? I exclaimed involuntarily.
John Harrow, Kitty said. Works downtown.
Not a banker like the big fella, clerky, you know, but kind. He'd walk Celeste to the corner sometimes so the boys at the soda place wouldn't bother. Brought her a book once. Poems, if you'll believe, Millet's, they call her. Celeste liked a poem to rhyme. Said life was troublesome enough without leaving off the rhyme. O'Malley scribbled.
You ever see Harrow here?
Once or twice, Kitty admitted.
Never upstairs.
He had a look in his face like he'd signed on the dotted line already, even if the paper wasn't in front of him. Celeste said he was a dear, but...
Kitty hesitated. She said he was serious. Too serious for her. She wanted...
And here Kitty's brave laugh returned and failed again. She wanted light. Poirot nodded as if a sum had balanced. He replaced the letters with a care that made me think he had, nevertheless, taken from them everything they could give. He turned next to the wardrobe. Two dresses, black and blue, a winter coat carefully brushed, a hat with a small veil, and, tucked into the pocket of the coat, a small rectangle of pasteboard.
A ticket, he said, for the ferry to Hoboken.
O'Malley's head came up.
Why Hoboken?
Because New York prefers not to be caught in its own mirrors, said Poirot. One goes where the eyes are fewer. He gave the ticket to the inspector. Dated 3 days ago.
Could be any errand, O'Malley said, but he did not seem to believe himself.
All right. We'll ask down by the slips. We were leaving when Poirot paused at the washstand. The cheap perfume bottle stood there, its label at once proud and embarrassed. He did not touch it. Instead, he bent to the porcelain dish beneath, and with the tip of his little finger drew from the rim a tiny smear of something dark and glossy.
Lipstick, I said. Bien sûr. But see the color, almost brown. The bottle upon the table is pink. Different shades, different moods. Yet our Mademoiselle LaRue prefers economy elsewhere. Why maintain two when one would do?
O'Malley shrugged. She had a friend. They get dressed together, they share.
Possibly, said Poirot, or possibly not.
On the pavement, the afternoon had sloped into that hour when New York grows impatient for its own night. Men in hats moved like purposeful chessmen. Girls in cloche caps clung to their laughter as to a ticket that might yet be checked at the door. We turned toward the river. O'Malley questioned at the ferry office with the dry efficiency of a man watering a stone. The ticket clerk remembered nothing, but a woman at a stand selling newspapers did.
Pretty girl, black dress, little hat.
Met a gentleman by the map. He was nervous, looked at his watch twice for every time he looked at her. I noticed because he stood on my shadow.
His age? Asked Poirot.
30s. Not rich, not poor. The kind that worries about his collar.
Thank you, said Poirot gravely, as though she had sung an aria.
You're J.H., I murmured when we had gone a little way.
Perhaps?
Perhaps not. Poirot's eyes had gone small and bright under their lids.
The ferry, the alley, the chain. Always there is a little movement out of sight, and then, poof, the dramatic gesture.
In crime, Hastings, the gesture is usually to hide something simple.
We crossed by the ferry ourselves and walked along the Hoboken frontage, where the breeze from the river scraped against one's cheek like the edge of paper. 10 minutes' talk with a patrolman, and we were directed to a modest boarding house in a street that had seen better varnish. The proprietress was Mrs. Loss, a sharp-eyed, pale woman with hands that knew their way around laundry and secrets. The insistence of coincidence pricked me. I had the sense of treading into a story already written, though the ink might differ. She denied knowledge at first with that rigid ignorance respectable women adopt when danger smells of headlines. Poirot, whose courtesy is a lever as well as a veil, coaxed, waited, and at last shook from her the admission that a young lady had come on several afternoons of late, always alone, always with the same serious young man.
"Business?" asked O'Malley. Mrs. Loss lifted her bony shoulders. "I don't inquire as to business."
They had a room, they talked. Sometimes the young lady cried, sometimes she didn't.
"Names?"
"She paid in cash. I call them as they come, Mr. and Miss."
"Did you see her last night?"
Poirot asked. The woman hesitated.
"No."
He sighed, not as a disappointed detective, but as a man who had hoped to spare someone a pain and could not. "And the young man, did he leave anything?"
"A habit, a word."
"A habit," she said at last uncertainly. He folded his gloves and put them in his hat while he spoke, as if he needed his hands free to think.
We thanked her and left.
O'Malley was in a glower.
"All right.
So she met a young man who isn't Rourke. Maybe she was stringing both along. Plenty of girls do."
"Plenty,"
Poirot agreed mildly, "but not this one. She is orderly. She keeps her things tidy. In her letters, she keeps the ribbon even. She would not scatter her affections like confetti." He slowed. "No, she is a girl who tries to avoid the noise. And yet the noise has found her." We reached the end of the block where the river interrupted the view with its flat black argument. Poirot stood looking at it, his head a little to one side. "We must see Mr. Harrow," he said.
"And we must see Mr. Rourke.
But one we will approach with the politesse, the other we will provoke."
"Provoke?" I said, startled.
"The man of power," said Poirot, "will not tell you a lie with care. He will swat you with it. When he does so, observe what falls from his sleeve. Back in Manhattan, O'Malley sent a man to fetch John Harrow from his office. We waited in a small room lined with files that smelt of glue and regret. Harrow arrived looking exactly as Miss Kitty had described, serious to the point of apology. He was in his early 30s, thin, with the sort of honest face a mother would trust with a rent envelope. When he saw the letters on the table, his color went.
"Where did you—"
"In her drawer," said O'Malley. "Sit down, Mr. Harrow." He did, carefully, as if the chair might complain. His hands lay folded on his knee. After a moment he took off his gloves, folded them, and placed them in his hat. Poirot's eyes half closed.
"You were fond of Miss LaRue," Poirot said gently.
"Yes," Harrow said. A single word, stripped of theatre. "Did you see her last night?" Harrow's eyes flicked, not toward the inspector, but toward the window, as though the city might offer him an alibi. "No." "Mr. Harrow," O'Malley said, and the name came out like a charge. "If you lie to me, I'll pull your life inside out and shake it." Harrow closed his eyes. "I went to the ferry," he said. "I waited. She didn't come. I walked. I ended up by the river on our side, and then I went home."
"At what hour?" said Poirot.
12:30. "Maybe closer to 1. Any person who saw you?"
"No."
"Why the ferry?" asked Poirot softly.
"Because she asked me."
He looked up, and there was a kind of nakedness in his face that made me like him. She was frightened. Not for herself, well, yes, for herself and for me. She said there was trouble. She didn't say what. Only that she was going to put something right and then we could... He faltered.
We could talk.
Put something right, repeated Poirot. And for that she goes not to the police, nor to the priest, nor even to the friend who is kind. She goes to a place where women cry in private rooms. His voice was neither harsh nor pitying. It was the voice of a surgeon naming an illness.
Monsieur, did you know of another man?
Harrow swallowed. Everyone knew there was someone. She wouldn't say who. She just said he was too big to move. Those were her words. And that if she said his name, I would be hurt. O'Malley snorted. Rourke. No, Harrow said with a sudden fierce exactitude. She didn't say. And I don't know. Poirot rose. Merci, Monsieur Harrow. Be at your rooms. We shall ask for you again.
When he had gone, O'Malley blew out a breath.
There it is. A triangle, a drowning, a scandal. We pick up Rourke. We squeeze. Poirot shook his head.
We do not squeeze the tiger. We tempt him to show his claws.
Send him word, Inspector, that a foreign detective is talking nonsense to the newspapers about the monogrammed case and the broken chain.
What good'll that do?
It will produce an action. And actions, unlike alibis, cannot be rehearsed. He turned to me with that neat finality that means he has already chosen the next scene. Come, Hastings. We shall pay a call at the Silver Gull.
At the club, again?
May we? There is a dressing room corridor, an alley, and between them, a staircase where a chain was broken. Someone replaces things after a storm. His moustaches shone like punctuation. It is time we looked for what has been tidied.
Chapter 4. Tidying the Scene. The Silver Gull was shuttered in daylight, its glitter damped down to the drabness of locked doors and empty barrels on the pavement. Inside, however, there was life. The manager, a pinched fellow with eyes as sharp as the corners of his collar, received us with bad grace.
I told the cops everything last night. Girl went out the back, didn't come back. We found her in the river. Sad business, but it's not on me.
Poirot spread his hands in a gesture of meek agreement.
We intrude only a little.
But you comprehend, monsieur, that in a house of entertainment, order is very precise. Tables here, chairs there, girls placed just so. A disturbance, it leaves the trace, n'est-ce pas?
The man sniffed. The only trace I want left is of paying customers.
Nevertheless, he permitted us to pass. The club in daylight was a skeleton of itself. Without the orchestra and the smoke, the long room seemed small, the tables cheap, the lamps ridiculous. Even the stage appeared shabby, its sequins tarnished. Poirot walked slowly down the length of it, peering at the scuffed floor, then turned into the corridor that led to the dressing rooms. A janitor was mopping there. The sharp reek of disinfectant rose about us. Poirot halted, his nose wrinkling.
Voila! Already the tidying. But one cannot mop away geometry.
I followed his gaze. The service stair, narrow and steep, descended to the alley. On the third step lay a faint discoloration, darker than the wood around it. Poirot bent without touching. A droplet. Dried. Not wine. The pattern suggests something spilled from above, perhaps in the struggle. The janitor muttered,
"Detectives always seeing what isn't there."
Poirot ignored him. "Come, Hastings. Let us examine the girl's last resting place before the river took her." We stepped into the alley. By daylight it was even less inviting. Litter in the corners, barrels awaiting collection, the dull clang of the L overhead. Poirot studied the wall by the door.
"See, Hastings, a smear. Faint but unmistakable. She was pressed here with force. The cigarette case fell. Then she was dragged or carried down to the water."
"Dragged?" I asked.
"Observe the scratches in the dust, parallel narrow.
Made by the heels of her shoes. The ground tells the story." We returned inside. Poirot requested to see the girls' dressing rooms. The manager resisted, but O'Malley, who had joined us, growled that it was police business.
The door was opened. The room contained a row of mirrors, their bulbs unlit, the faint perfume of powder clinging to the air. Trifles lay on the dressing tables, rouge tins, combs, a stocking with a ladder. Poirot stood still as though awaiting a revelation. Then, with a little exclamation, he pointed to the far end.
"Hastings, what do you see?"
"I saw nothing beyond the ordinary. A cupboard half open, containing costumes." Poirot went to it, drew out a dress of shimmering silver cloth, and held it up. The sequins caught the dim light.
"This is not hers," he said. "Celeste danced last in black, you remember, yet here is a costume, still faintly warm from use, hung away in haste. Another girl wore it? Perhaps. But there, look at the hem." I bent. Along the edge was a faint stain, brown, irregular.
"Blood?" I whispered.
"Perhaps. Or the rouge from a broken compact. But consider the haste, Hastings. Someone returns here after the death, exchanges garments, conceals a mark. The murderer tidies."
O'Malley's jaw tightened.
"One of the other girls, then."
"Or someone who entered by this door," said Poirot.
"Consider, Inspector, it is not necessary to be a dancer to step into a dressing room. We interviewed two of the cigarette girls who had known Celeste. Their tales were similar. She was admired, envied a little, but not hated. She had spoken often of getting free. One recalled that Celeste had lately confided she meant to leave New York. 1 week, 2 at most," she had said.
"To go where?" Poirot asked.
"She didn't say. Only that it would be far." The girl's eyes widened. "She said she had money saved."
"Enough?"
Poirot made a note. When we emerged once more into the blue-shadowed corridor, O'Malley muttered, "Running away with Harrow?"
"Perhaps. But remember, Inspector, she did not tell him where she went last night. She feared he would be harmed."
We walked again into the daylight. The street was noisy, indifferent to tragedy. Poirot paused, his head inclined. "The pattern is clearer. The young man Harrow, he is earnest, but poor. Rourke, the man of power, careless with women. Yet Celeste looked not at Rourke when she danced.
None.
She looked everywhere but. It is not love, not longing. It is fear."
"Fear of exposure," O'Malley said. "He's married."
"She threatens scandal. He panics."
Poirot shook his head gently.
"Non, non. A man like Rourke does not panic. He buys, he silences, he arranges. Murder is untidy. Yet here, so much tidying afterward. It is not in his manner."
"Then who?" I asked.
Poirot smiled faintly. "We return to the initials, Hastings. J.H. He is kind, he is poor, and he is serious. But sometimes seriousness, when faced with despair, grows dangerous. We must see him again."
O'Malley swore under his breath.
"If Harrow did it, why toss her in the river?"
"To make it appear as accident, perhaps. Or to confuse.
Remember, Inspector, New York has known already a girl found in the Hudson whose death was never solved. Someone copies, thinking history will protect him."
As we drove back, Poirot sat very upright, his eyes half closed.
"There is something missing.
Something small, precise. When I find it, the picture will be complete."
Chapter 5. The Case in Order.
The precinct room looked like a schoolroom that had decided to take itself seriously. There was a long table, a row of straight chairs, a black ledger, and a clock that ticked as if it had been born to accuse. Inspector O'Malley sat at the far end with the ledger and an unlit cigar. The city hissed against the windows. Poirot had arranged us as carefully as a hostess places silver. Rourke came first with his lawyer, large, florid, contemptuous. John Harrow, pale and exact, twisting his hat. Kitty Boyle, small and brave, on the edge of tears. The manager of the Silver Gull, defensive as a hedgehog. And Mrs. Loss, the landlady, upright, hands composed in her lap, her face a door with a bolt on the inside.
Poirot rose. His neatness made the table seem suddenly tidy as well.
"Mesdames et messieurs," he said, "we will not argue. We will only arrange. When the little facts take their proper places, the truth sits down of itself."
"Make it quick," Rourke said. "Some of us work."
"Some of us," said Poirot pleasantly, "work very hard to stay unseen."
He laid a single object on the table, Celeste's silver cigarette case, its fine chain broken.
"Fact the first. This chain snapped on the service stair inside the Silver Gull. The links are sprung cleanly. The case itself is unscuffed. That is a sudden wrench at the wrist in close quarters. On the door jamb by the stair, there is the faint smear where a shoulder struck. In the alley, drag marks. Heels together, not walking. Therefore, the assault occurred inside, not at the river. The river is the last convenience, not the scene."
The manager shifted.
"Then it was one of the girls?" he muttered. "Or a musician?"
"No," O'Malley said shortly. "We checked the band."
Poirot inclined his head. "We concern ourselves with access. Who is able to be behind the scenes without causing exclamation? Staff, and those who pass as staff. Someone known, someone who brings notes, collects parcels, someone whom your janitor calls." He turned to the manager. "The aunt."
The manager swallowed and glanced at Mrs. Loss. She did not oblige him with a look.
Rourke's lawyer cleared his throat. "Is this a charge?"
"It is a table setting," Poirot said. "Charges are the soup course. I serve dessert."
"I have never seen a grown financier look so like a schoolboy who has brought the wrong book."
Poirot's small fingers arranged the case so the light showed the broken links.
"Now the suspects, one by one. Monsieur Rourke, the newspapers shout your name. You are a man accustomed to arrangements. If you feared this girl's talk, what would you do?"
"Nothing," said Rourke with a small ugly smile. "Or pay someone else to do it."
"Just so," said Poirot. "You would not lay hands upon her in a public house, nor drag her yourself in the dirt. Your weapon is the checkbook. The method is wrong." Rourke started to speak. His lawyer trod on his foot. "Monsieur Harrow." Poirot's tone softened. "You wrote letters.
You waited at the ferry. Your vice is sincerity, not violence. You have no passage behind the scenes, no bouncer who owes you a favor, no habit of moving where you do not belong. You are innocent of murder and guilty of heartbreak."
Harrow's mouth trembled. He bowed his head. Kitty reached for his hand. He let her take it.
"And you, Mademoiselle Boyle," said Poirot. "You know the dressing rooms and the alleys. You have the right footprint, if you like. But you lack the will and the tidying. You would have run. You would not have arranged."
"I couldn't hurt her," Kitty whispered. "Even if sometimes I wished I were her."
Poirot nodded. "Envy is untidy. This crime, alas, was tidy." He turned at last to Mrs. Loss. If she felt the room's eyes, she did not show it.
"There is a person," Poirot said, "whose trade is discretion. She arranges discreet meetings. She keeps the names out of rooms where men know how to sue. To such a person, order is bread. To her, disorder is ruin. And our poor Celeste," he looked at the silver case, "she threatened disorder."
"I arrange nothing," Mrs. Loss said. "Girls need rooms."
"Gentlemen pay for rooms. It is a moral city. One must be practical."
"Morality," Poirot murmured, "is often a list of other people's errors. Let us continue with the facts."
He lifted a small card.
"The ferry ticket found in Celeste's coat, she planned to leave. She told Kitty she had money saved. She meant to be free, perhaps for the first time in her life. She also had the careless notes of Monsieur Rourke, appointments, not endearments. With them she could speak. Speak of him, and of the woman who kept the ledger of introductions. If she spoke, whose life would be smashed? The banker's? He would deny. The girl would be traduced. It is the landlady who is dragged through the courts. Mrs. Loss's mouth twitched.
You've read the newspapers, she said. They always find a woman to blame.
Ah, said Poirot, but tonight we seek not blame but cause. Rourke snorted. Stop the sermon. If you're naming her, name her.
Patience, said Poirot gently. I have one more little thing, the smallest of all, and therefore the most telling.
He turned to O'Malley.
Inspector, when first we visited Madame Loss, what did she remark about Monsieur Harrow?
O'Malley's brow creased. That business about his gloves, he said. How he folds them into his hat while he talks.
Exactment, said Poirot. Celeste never went to the ferry, yet Madame spoke of the clerk's little habit with his gloves, as though she had stood beside him. How could she know? Because she followed Celeste to the club, and on her way back she saw Harrow waiting, anxious, fidgeting. She stored away the detail, as tidy souls do, and when she repeated it to us later, she betrayed herself.
I look out for my boarders, Mrs. Loss said coolly. It is a rough neighbourhood.
There is also the small matter of lipstick, Poirot said, almost apologetically, as if discussing laundry. In Celeste's room, upon the washstand, there was a faint smear of brown, not Celeste's. Hers was pink.
A contradiction, but only if the room belonged to one woman.
In truth, that room had two women in it on certain afternoons, Celeste and the woman who came to tidy and advise.
Madame Loss still wears the old shade. The girls do not.
It is a small thing, but it is the sort of small thing that makes a bridge in the mind, from the girl's private life to the public place where she died. It shows connection. It shows proximity. And it belongs to the woman who cannot keep from putting things in order.
Lipstick, Rourke's lawyer sneered. You hang a murder on a smear of colour?
I hang the murder, said Poirot mildly, on access, motive, and method. The colour merely points to the correct woman.
The manager of the Silver Gull cleared his throat.
I have seen Mrs. Loss in the back corridors. All the time, really. She carries messages. Everyone knows her.
Thank you, monsieur, Poirot said. Invisible people are best seen by those who also live invisibly.
Rourke shifted in his chair. If the point is to absolve me...
The point, snapped O'Malley, for once losing patience, is to hang the right hat on the right peg.
Harrow lifted his head. If she's guilty, he said in a strained voice, say it plain.
Poirot's eyes softened. He looked at Mrs. Loss.
Madame, he said, I will be plain.
You followed Celeste to the club. You passed where you often passed. In the service corridor you stopped her. Perhaps you begged. Perhaps you threatened. She resisted. You seized her wrist. Snap went the chain. She cried out. You pressed her back against the jamb. In panic you silenced her. When she fell limp, you did what you always do. You tidied. You removed her bracelet, a keepsake, or a thought of removing a mark. You took the simplest route out. You dragged her along the alley where the dust still held the shape of her heels.
The river received her. Back inside you put straight what looked wrong, and you went home to your house that is clean as a parlour in a catalogue.
Mrs. Loss did not move. Kitty gave a small moan. Harrow's lips parted and closed again.
"Is this the part," Rourke said softly, dangerously, "where you demand a confession?"
Poirot shook his head. "No, I present a choice. Madame Loss can deny everything. She can say the corridor is full of ghosts and the manager remembers the wrong aunt. But it will not matter. The pattern is what it is. It is the pattern of a woman who lives by keeping quiet and who, for once, kept too much."
For the first time, Mrs. Loss's hands left her lap. She placed them flat on the table, palms down, as though feeling for an earthquake. When she spoke, her voice was low, not theatrical.
"She would have ruined me," she said. "You do not know what that means."
When men fall, they have nets, clubs, partners, lawyers. When girls fall, they vanish. When I fall, there is a headline and a cell and nothing afterwards. I kept things proper. You may not like the trade, but within it I kept it clean. No beatings, no filth, money on time. Names not spoken, and she... She drew a breath that sounded like a tear she had decided not to let fall. She laughed. She said she would tell it all. She did not say where she would go, because she would have nowhere. She would have set the whole house on fire. I could not let her. Harrow half rose. She wanted to live. She wanted to be...
To be free, Mrs. Loss said, and now the tears came. She dashed it away angrily. Do you think I do not know that word? I have been paying rent to it all my life. I told her not to be foolish. She fought. Her mouth tightened. I meant to frighten, not to kill, but it takes very little to stop a throat that has sung and laughed for its bread.
O'Malley made a motion. The two constables at the wall stepped forward. Mrs. Loss stood of her own accord and held out her wrists. At the door she looked back at Poirot, as if about to say something else, then closed her mouth on it as a prudent woman closes a drawer. The door shut. Rourke stood with a grunt, and told his lawyer they were leaving. Kitty began to cry properly, in little folded sobs that tried not to go far. Harrow stared at the silver case as though it were a grave. Poirot picked up the objects one by one and returned them to his valise. He was very gentle with the broken chain. We stepped out into a street that had decided to be noisy again. The Hudson lay at the end of the avenue like a strip of tarnished metal. A tug hooted. A boy cried the evening edition. Someone laughed in a way that had nothing to do with happiness. So, I said, we never learn why she was at the club, or how she first fell into that life, or what she would have done if she had got away. No, said Poirot, we learn only what is needed to set the pieces in their proper places. We know she wished to go, we know someone wished her to stay quiet. Between these two wishes, Hastings, there is often a rope. Rourke walks away, I said bitterly. For now, said O'Malley behind us. His voice was as dry as his ledger. He won't like what comes next. Poirot's eyes followed the river. It is not for me to balance all accounts, he said softly. It is only for me to say where the hand was and what it did. Men like Rourke are a climate. We dress for them. Women like Madame Loss are a house. We can enter or we can knock it down. Celeste, she was a person. She wished for a small, dangerous thing, freedom. He touched my sleeve. Come, mon ami. The ship south does not enjoy lateness. And crime is a traveller, with many tickets. We walked toward the river lights. Behind us the city resumed its appetite. Before us the water lifted and fell as patiently as a chest asleep. And so concludes Poirot and the Lady of the Hudson, a case of city lights and shadowed rooms, where discretion kept its own ledger, and the river carried more than reflections. This story was written by us in homage to Agatha Christie, inspired by the true, unsolved case of Mary Rogers, yet entirely original in its telling. If you've listened to the end, thank you. Your encouragement, reflections, and thoughtful comments are what make sharing these mysteries a joy. I spend time with each one and try to reply whenever I can. If you'd like to go further, you can join our membership or leave a small tip. But simply by being here, listening, and sharing, you're already giving more than enough. Until our next mystery. Good night.